Hello and welcome to Volume 84 of Capital Ideas Live. In today's issue, we'll talk to a geological consultant about accessing minerals on your property. We'll investigate the reaction to a speech recently by the Secretary of Agriculture, and we'll speak to someone who challenges the common wisdom about climate change. We'll also check on the status of the timber market. I'm Hayes Brown, the General Counsel of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, and I'll be your host for today's discussion. When popular opinion on climate change seems uniformly pointed in one direction, it's useful to listen to the skeptic, the voice who has the courage to speak up in the other direction. Certainly, there are preselected thoughts about climate change prepared in advance for you, but Mark Morano has weighed the evidence on climate change and found it wanting. Welcome, Mark.
Hey, thank you for having me on the program.
The science of global warming, do you feel that it's strong, weak, or exaggerated?
It is so weak that the United Nations top scientists, Professor Latif out of Germany, are now telling the UN at UN conferences that they have a problem on their hands because we may be facing either two decades of no cooling or global cooling, two more decades. Keep in mind, the high point of global temperatures was 1998 in recent years. So the scientific consensus is essentially crumbling underneath the United Nations, and we have UN scientists now leading the charge on this.
The solutions that are opposed to fight global warming are cap and trade, renewable energy subsidies, and those type of things. What do you see as the cost of instituting those type remedies?
Well, there's actually two issues here. There's the cost and there's the impact on the climate. The most important thing for your for the forestry industry to understand here is that both the United Nations solutions, the Kyoto Protocol, and the U.S. Congressional Climate Bill would have no detectable impact on the climate, assuming Al Gore and the UN were correct on the science. They're purely symbolic bills that have huge economic costs. And you don't have to take Climate Depot or Mark Morano or anyone else's word for this. You can look at the cost by just simply looking at Obama administration documents. The CBS News is just reporting this morning, and it's a headline, that the Obama administration's internal documents that were released for freedom of information are showing this may cost families up to $1,700-plus per year, the climate bill, and do nothing for the climate, and it's the equivalent of hiking income taxes by up to 15%. That's what we're talking about with this climate bill. It's going to have huge costs all across the broad spectrum of energy and manufacturing, and it's going to have a regressive impact. As Obama's own advisor, Warren Buffett, said, it's a huge regressive tax.
Forest owners are encouraged to produce carbon offsets and put them in permanent fashion by putting in permanent conservation easements to house these carbon offsets. What is your view on that?
You know, this whole carbon offset, Al Gore's quest is to become the first carbon billionaire. There's a Chicago Climate Exchange, there's exchanges in London. Right now, because of the faltering climate bill in the U.S. Congress, the cost, I believe at one point, was $7 or $8 per unit of CO2 in the Chicago Climate Exchange. That's now dropped as of last week to 26 cents per unit. The market is having serious problems. It can only exist with draconian government mandates, which, of course, the people behind the carbon markets are promoting on lobbying on Capitol Hill. My advice to forestry people dealing with this is stay as far away as possible, but to the extent that you're going to have mandates or be forced to get involved, obviously try to get the best deal, but realize it's doing absolutely nothing for the biosphere, for the climate. In fact, geologists are now saying we're in a CO2 dearth. So the more CO2 we can actually get in the atmosphere is not going to be a bad thing. And that's what we're finding. In fact, there's a new study out that says cities are actually more better for the environment than forests in some level. So there's all kinds of it's called urban jungle. Cities trap more carbon than rainforests. Surprising study finds. It's something new. So the bottom line is don't get caught up in the hysteria. Realize what you're doing is purely symbolic. Realize it's a gimmick. If you're forced to do it for business reasons or marketing, then so be it. But I would try to stay as far away as possible.
All right. Thank you, Mark. We appreciate that. So the Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack, made waves recently in a speech on the state of the forest in the U.S. He could have called the speech the forest of the state because he seemed to show an insensitivity to the distinction between public and private forests. Scott Jones of the Forest Landowners Association gave voice to private owners in response to the speech. Hello, Scott.
Good morning.
How do you feel the content of Secretary Vilsack's speech was problematic?
Well, really, in his speech, Secretary paired public and private forest together, which is not so much the issue, because that happens quite often when addressing, like, say, forest in the U.S. The real problem, with pairing those together is that he categorized their health as critically impaired. And we took exception with that, knowing that, of course, we have had impaired forest health on public lands for quite some time, which is demonstrated through out-of-control wildfires and bug infestations. But on the other hand, private forests have been an example about how good management and private management of forests can create very, very good benefits for society and for the landowners themselves. So when he paired those together, that created an issue for us. But also, on top of that, he pointed to increased government intervention as a possible solution to this critically impaired health of all of our forest. Mm-hmm. So that was the main issue.
How did others in the forester community view the speech?
I think most of the forester community, as we were kind of excited and somewhat surprised to hear the Secretary address forests. And most generally had a positive reaction to his comments. I think now that the administration is showing interest in private forests, it's really important that we establish a working relationship with them so that we can address the needs of private forests properly.
What does your organization, the Forest Landowners Association, feel should be the proper role of the Department of Agriculture concerning private forests?
Well, you know, this is something that most secretaries of agriculture have not addressed forests in the past, but now that they're showing interest in private forests and forests in general, we feel they can really play a role of guidance to the administration and Congress when they're considering legislation and regulation on private lands. And I'll give you an example. The secretary noted in his speech the key role forests play in providing clean drinking water to our country. Yet Congress right now is set to debate a Clean Water Restoration Act, which would have serious impacts and act as a disincentive to private forest owners on their property. So, on one hand, if we have the administration saying, you know, our forests are providing clean water and clean drinking water, we need those things, yet Congress is passing disincentives to landowners continuing to manage their land for clean water, then we have one hand not talking to the other. So they can act as a guiding body to, I'd say, to Congress, the administration, when they're considering these items that might act as disincentives to private landowners.
Okay. Scott, we appreciate that. Thank you for joining us. Our next guest is Tanya Baker, who uses goats for land management, and we would note the transition from the halls of Congress to goats is entirely incidental. Tanya and her husband live in Arizona. Hello, Tanya.
Hi, Hayes.
Why do you use goats for land management?
Well, Hayes, I like to say, picture a herd of about 90 to 100 goats eating away at large sections of overgrown brush, weeds, thistle, and for us in Arizona, anything that's flammable. It's clean, it's quiet, it's ecologically better than any other land clearing effort, and on top of that, goats will naturally fertilize the ground and keep it well packed. Goats can be used effectively in almost any location or terrain type, especially in terrains that are too rocky or steep for human or machine clearing. And because the goats are tightly managed by trained handlers, they're kept from overgrazing and make wonderful option for brush abatement, brush management, and weed control.
Well, since you've been doing this for a while, I bet you picked up some tricks of the trade. What are your secrets?
Well, what we found is in order to gain the desired effects of goat land clearing, the goats need to be contained in smaller acreage plots, what we call high-density, short-duration browsing or managed intensive browsing. We do this by using portable electric net fencing that's charged by solar-powered battery chargers, so we can work in all areas, even those without electricity. And if you just turn the goats out to be herded by dogs or people, they'll continually wander, and you will not see the high-density desired effects on the land, and your chances of losing them to predators is much greater.
Okay. Other than what you mentioned, are there other benefits to having goats on your property?
There are. I can't say I grew up wanting to be a goat rancher. It kind of happened. But there's different types of goats, and each type has its own unique usage, meat goats, dairy goats, and hair goats. We raise both meat goats and dairy goats, and either type can be used, either type is used in our herd for our land clearing business. We use an all-nanny herd for land clearing, and we have them bred for their specific purpose, either meat or dairy. We have our nanny's kid on the ranch, and when it's time to wean the kids from their mothers, we'll put most of the female kids back into the nanny herd, and they go to work on our land clearing business. And then the neutered males, they'll be raised for our meat goat business.
Okay. All right. Thank you for that, Tanya. We appreciate it. Well, we're pleased to have with us John Waltney, who is president of Forestry Suppliers. But he's not here to talk about his products, but about a website that he developed on southeastern flora, which depicts over 1,000 species of wildflowers. Welcome, John.
Good morning. Thank you for being on your program.
What motivated you to create this website?
Well, excuse me, when our daughter was in school, she had to do a wildflower collection, and got to looking, and there were very few reference books on plant identification in their library. And ever since college, I'd been collecting books on plant identification, so references for her were not a problem, but they were lacking for others in her class. And after a while, the combination of the Internet and digital photography came along, and it made this reference available to anyone with Internet access, and it's free to use.
What do you need to know already about plants before you come to this website?
If you can identify a color, that's really all you need. This site was developed and designed for, say, the seventh grade level, so nobody needs to know anything about plants. There's no formal training about botany that would be required. When a user goes into the site and all they do is say the flower is yellow, for example, there's some other questions that they can answer that will help narrow down the search. But if all they know is the color, then it will give them a thumbnail photograph of all the plants that met their criteria. And when you look over the photographs, the thumbnails, and you find one that you think might be a match for your plant, then click on that thumbnail, and it will take you to the page for that species.
This may be part of your answer, but by now there are other websites and field guides. How is your site different?
Well, Southeastern Flora is different because it actually helps you identify a plant. Now, most websites have real good information, reference information, and have really nice photographs to help confirm the identification of a plant. But they're not much help in identification. So if you're starting from scratch, you got to have some way to get to a name.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the other reference that most people use with wildflowers is field guide type books. And all of the field guides obviously are limited by paper and ink restraints, and they usually only have one photograph for each plant. And in some cases, it takes more than just a body shot to tell what the plant is. For example, some yard weeds like dead nettle and henbit are very similar-looking species. They both occur very widely distributed. They occur in the same areas. But one has leaves that are on little stalks or petioles, and the other species has sessile leaves. So you need to really get down to some smaller details.
Okay.
Even with pine trees, you need to know the difference in the number of needles in a fascicle or the length of the needles or bark characteristics to be able to tell one plant from another. Now, some plants only need one photograph, like a passion flower or a maypop. There's nothing else out there that looks like that.
All right. Well, we'll put a link to that site on the website. We appreciate it, John. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's not uncommon for forest land in Alabama also to contain valuable mineral deposits. Bob Carr is a geology consultant with a wealth of knowledge about minerals in Alabama. Hello, Bob.
Good morning, Hayes. Thanks for having me on.
This is your business, but tell us why a landowner should hire someone like you who's an experienced geologist to help them with their minerals.
Well, they just need someone that has experience in the area, knowing what minerals occur and what the geology of the local area is where their property is owned.
Mm-hmm. Now, give us an idea. We've obviously heard of coal deposits, maybe oil and gas, but what are the valuable rocks and minerals that could be found in Alabama?
Well, in addition to coal, oil and gas, and coal bed methane, Alabama's got a diverse minerals, including limestone, dolomite, iron ore, granite, mica, sand and gravel, marble, just to name a few.
If you had these type products on your land, would you know them or be able to recognize them, or would you need to have someone help you in marketing these?
The landowner might be aware of some of the minerals that are on their property, but to as I said before, hire an experienced geologist that knows the diverse minerals that might be there. The geologist could help them design and monitor mineral exploration to identify and evaluate the minerals that are on the property, both for quantity and quality. And, you know, if the landowner is interested in cashing in on his pot of gold that he might be sitting on,
mm-hmm.
An experienced geologist would know the mining companies that are in there that have the experience and the equipment to do the mining, and could negotiate a lease with the mining company, and then once mining begins, experienced geologists could do the monitoring of the mining to make sure that the mining company complies with the terms and conditions of the lease and make sure that the landowner gets the income from his property.
Just on the front end, it's all the way through the lease term.
All the way through the process. And then the landowner can, in the negotiations of the lease, define the reclamation that's done to his property and up to and including what is planted, the you know, slope of the property. If he wants a lake left on his property, he can do that on the front end. He can't do that after the mining permit is granted to the miner.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Bob. We appreciate those thoughts. Appreciate you joining us.
Thank you, Hayes.
Dr. Mike Kane is the director of a research cooperative involving plantation management, and we wanted to have him tell us what he's been up to. Welcome, Dr. Kane.
Glad to be here, Hayes.
Your organization is called the Plantation Management Research Cooperative. What is that?
Well, we're a cooperative organization between the University of Georgia's Warnell School of Forestry and Natural Resources and private plantation growers. We began in 1975, and our objective is to improve the understanding of how different silvicultural practices affect the productivity and value of loblolly and slash pine plantations throughout the South. We currently have 16 members of the cooperative, and they represent about 60% of the 32 million acres of pine plantations in the South. Our members provide direction in terms of what type of research that we do, and they provide financial support, so I would like to recognize them for the support that they've given the program for the last 34 years.
What are some of the cooperative's accomplishments and products?
Well, we have two main products. One is related to quantifying how silvicultural treatments affect productivity and value of pine plantations, and the second main product is actually systems of growth and yield models that help forest managers predict how these stands develop. Some of the key products on the silvicultural side is we've done a lot of research that looks at and compares loblolly and slash pine performance on different soil types, and that's provided clarity in terms of what species to plant on different sites. We've looked a lot at how vegetation control treatments affect plantation productivity and value, and we've also looked at how combinations of tree improvement through genetics and silvicultural practices like competition control
mm-hmm.
affect productivity and value.
What are some of the current research priorities that y'all are working on?
Okay, right now we have a couple of large focuses that really come together to help us look at managing plantations for multiple products ranging from biomass to saw timber southwide. And those two new focus areas are really looking at how different planting densities or number of trees per acre that are planted combined with different types of silvicultural regimes, how those affect yields from these plantations. And right now we have some results through about age 10 or 12, and we're looking forward to getting those published and available to the public. We also have a major effort right now looking at mid-rotation treatments, and those are treatments kind of around thinning pine plantations, where we look at different thinning regimes in combinations with fertilization and competition control treatments.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Kane. We appreciate you joining us.
I appreciate the opportunity.
All-terrain vehicles have been a common tool or toy, depending on who you ask, for forest owners. Gannon Murphy has developed a for-profit ATV trail on his land in Alabama, so we invited him to share his experience. Welcome, Gannon.
Good morning, Hayes.
What prompted you to develop an ATV trails park?
Well, we were looking for other ways to create more revenue other than just hunting leases and thinning. And, of course, we found out, too, that we already had ATVers trespassing on the property.
Mm-hmm. Might as well charge them.
Yeah. Yes.
It seems that it wouldn't be much to opening up a trail. Is it a really quick and easy thing for a forest landowner to do?
Well, there is more to building an ATV park than many would imagine. Just simply taking a piece of land and opening the gates would be ideal, but it is far from reality as to what has to happen.
Tell us some of the considerations that you made when you opened up your park and what kind of the challenges you faced.
Well, some of the things to consider, of course, would be location and proximity to the urban markets, because I think it's the urban markets that really support this.
Mm-hmm.
Zoning issues, parking, noise, traffic, and neighbors, those are all of those kind of combined with your neighbors. Of course, you want limited and controlled access. Utilities availability, the cost of that, and the cost of running electricity and so forth, and don't forget sewer issues. Trail design and building, water and silt control, and, of course, marketing and sales.
Okay. Now, if someone was interested in following you in this business, where could you get more information?
Well, there are several sources for gathering information now on the Internet. Excuse me. And I've had personally some very good help with some folks in Alabama, a fellow named Glenn Myers. He's the president of something called the Cheehaw Trail Riders.
Mm-hmm.
They have helped quite a bit in the trail design and input on how the park should be laid out and that sort of thing. We are having people are welcome to come by the park, call me, come by the park and take a look at it if they want to. And we are having a benefit for the Make-A-Wish Foundation November the 15th. And that would be a great time to come out, meet some manufacturers, some dealers, Glenn Myers and Cheehaw Trail Riders, and, of course, speak to me if they want to.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Gannon. Appreciate you joining us.
Thank you.
Well, in our markets chair is Jack Lutz. Hello, Jack.
Hello. Glad to be here.
Can you tell us when housing starts are expected to recover and why we should be watching that number?
Yeah. Let me address the second part of that question first. It's important because about 60% of the lumber, softwood lumber we produce in the U.S. goes into our houses. So when we're not building houses, we don't need lumber, and people don't need our saw timber. Now, as to when it's going to recover, I want to stress that this is really speculative. It depends on the general economy, but we've been told by the Fed chair yesterday that we seem to be done with the recession. But long-term, over the last 50 years, we have averaged 1.5 million housing starts a year. This year, we are expected to start just over 500,000, so about a third of the long-term average. And it's going to take a couple years to climb out of that. I recently looked at a bunch of organizations' forecasts for housing starts. We're not going to get up to the long-term average till about 2012. So it will be two or three more years of not much demand for lumber, which, again, goes back to our forests, and people aren't going to need too much of our saw timber.
Okay. Well, let's shift over to the pulpwood market. How is it going to look in the next couple of years, according to your forecast?
Yeah, well, that the news there isn't so bad, but of course the pulpwood isn't quite as valuable. Paper demand hasn't fallen off quite as much as lumber demand did. Part of that's due to a black liquor credit, energy tax credit that some of the paper mills got. So that's kept demand for pulpwood up. The other thing to look at is we need to come up with a new term for what we've been calling pulpwood, because a lot of that is now going into the BOSB mills, the panel mills, and a lot of it's going to be going into producing electricity or wood pellets, or in the not-too-distant future, it might go into making ethanol and other wood-based chemicals. So long-term, I think there's good demand for pulpwood. The issue is maybe over the next few months, it's not going to be all that exciting.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Jack, for that, and we appreciate it. And that's all the time we have for this issue. Our thanks go to Mark Morano, Scott Jones, Tanya Baker, and John Guatney. We also appreciate the contributions of Bob Carr, Michael Kane, Gannon Murphy, and Jack Lutz. On behalf of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, I'm Hayes Brown. Thank you for joining us for this issue of Capital Ideas Live.